question. How can good Buddhists committed to not killing enjoy the results of murder by eating meat, fowl, and fish? Answer. In Buddhist scriptures on discipline, eating meat is not prohibited. Also, monks and nuns, in a sense, are mendicants going out and begging for food, and thus do not state a preference such as, I would like such and such kind of food. Buddhist monks and nuns are, therefore, neither necessarily vegetarian nor non-vegetarian. In the Bodhisattva vehicle, the general emphasis is on being vegetarian. Not eating meat is considered to be preferable, and I think this is the proper practice. Then, in the Tantra vehicle, the three lower Tantra sets, action, performance, and yoga, prohibit meat eating. But in highest yoga Tantra, there is no prohibition. These are explanations offered by the scriptures on discipline, the sutra vehicle, and the mantra vehicle. More specifically, it is unsuitable to have an animal killed for oneself. For example, in a market in a big city, meat is already available, but where no meat is available, it is not suitable to say, I want meat. Still, the best way is to be vegetarian. I myself tried in 1965 to become a vegetarian and remained so for 22 months. Then I contracted jaundice and was advised by my physician to discontinue vegetarianism. For those who can follow strict vegetarianism, that is best. Question. Several of us had to tell a few lies at work to be able to come here and benefit from your teaching. Is the bad karma acquired from telling lies countered by the good karma acquired through learning? Answer. It depends on how much benefit is gained. If you implement the teachings and gain something, then it is worthwhile. In Buddhism, the most important considerations are the results of our actions. We have to distinguish what to do and not to do in terms of what can be accomplished. In this context, activities completely prohibited in the scriptures on discipline are not only allowed but are required under certain circumstances. They must be done if they will be beneficial. Just as in medical treatment, different medicines are used by the same person under new circumstances, when purifying the mind, different circumstances call for implementation of different techniques. Lecture 4. The Value of Altruism. The practice of the three trainings in ethics, meditative stabilization, and wisdom is capable of destroying the afflictive emotions. However, it is also necessary to get rid of the latent predispositions established by afflictive emotions, and this is extremely difficult. The reason for seeking to eradicate those is that they prevent simultaneous knowledge of all objects of knowledge. The question is how to destroy these predisposing tendencies. The weapon is the wisdom that understands emptiness. But to overcome such latencies, great merit is needed. The technique for accumulating great merit is unusual altruism. Until now, the main concern has been with oneself. In altruistic practice, the concern is with all sentient beings. Sentient beings are limitless. Therefore, when one's consciousness is concerned with this infinite number of sentient beings, the meritorious power accumulated is also limitless. Hence, going for refuge to the Buddha, the doctrine, and the spiritual community out of concern for oneself, and going for refuge out of concern for a limitless number of sentient beings differ greatly in their meritorious power. Also, until now, the aim has been to achieve mere liberation from cyclic existence, extinguishment of suffering, for oneself. With a more altruistic motivation, the aim is the highest possible attainment, Buddhahood. This entails extinction not just of the afflictive obstructions, but also of their predispositions, which constitute the obstructions to omniscience. Thus, also from the viewpoint of the goal, the practices of the altruistically motivated person seeking highest enlightenment will be more powerful and accumulate greater meritorious force. The nature of an altruistic mind is precious. It is amazing that the human mind can forget oneself and consider every other being to be as dear as oneself. That is truly marvelous. I think that with such an attitude, all of cyclic existence would be like nirvana. This is the real source of happiness, not only in the long run, but even today. If even the slightest experience of this develops, it will help by bestowing peace of mind and inner strength. It attracts the best of all experiences and provides the best ground for active participation in society. It serves not only as a teacher, but also as best friend and protector. It is truly good. This morning, we discussed the philosophical structure that allows us to conclude that it is possible to develop such a beautiful mind. The great Indian Panditas set forth two techniques for development of altruism, one through the seven quintessential instructions of cause and effect, and the other through equalizing and switching self and other. Preceded by developing equanimity with respect to all beings, the seven quintessential instructions are: 1. Recognize all as friends. 2. Reflect on their kindness. 3. Develop an intention to repay that kindness. 4. Generate love. 5. Generate compassion. 6. Develop the resolve of universal responsibility. And 7. Engender an altruistic intention to become enlightened. To generate such a strong attitude in which one promises to seek Buddhahood for the sake of others, it is necessary to generate resolve in which one takes on the burden of others' welfare. To induce this unusual resolve, it is necessary to have compassion in which one cannot bear to see either the manifest suffering of others or their oppression by internal conditions. Thus, from the depths of the heart, one wishes that they be freed from such a condition. 4. Unless one is stirred from the depths by compassion, the high resolve in which one takes on the burden of freeing beings from suffering cannot be induced. It is clear from our own experience that it is easier to generate compassion for persons who are attractive to oneself. Thus, prior to generating great compassion, one needs a technique to cause all sentient beings to appear appealing. This involves viewing all sentient beings the way we view those to whom we are the closest. To view beings this way, it is helpful to use the imagination. Imagine in front of yourself a friend, an enemy, and someone to whom you are completely indifferent. Examine your feelings to see whom you hold dear and whom you consider in a distant manner. Naturally, you feel close to your friend. You feel not only distant, but sometimes angry or irritated toward your enemy. You just feel nothing for the neutral person. You have to investigate why this is so. The first one is your best friend. However, from the Buddhist viewpoint, although today he or she is acting like a friend, this is not permanent, because over the course of beginningless rebirths, in some past lifetime, he or she may have been one of your worst enemies. Similarly, although the other one is today acting like an enemy, you cannot be sure that in a past life he or she was not one of your dearest friends. In the future also, there is no reason why an enemy must always remain an enemy and a friend remain a friend. There is no guarantee even within this life. Today's friend, within a short time, may change. Things are always changing, changing, changing. Sometimes we are successful, sometimes unsuccessful. The basic life structure is not at all stable. Therefore, our experience of such solid feelings towards friends and enemies is absolutely wrong. There is no reason to assume such rigidity. It is foolish, is it not? Considering this will gradually help you become even-minded. The next step is to think that, given that your enemy was in the past or will sooner or later be a good friend, it is much better to consider all three persons as your best friends. Also, you can investigate whether there is value in showing hatred. What kind of result will come from it? The answer is obvious. However, if you try to develop compassion towards these persons, there is no question that the result will be nice. From this viewpoint, you can see it is much better to develop a compassionate attitude equally toward all three types of beings. Extend this feeling toward your neighbors, one by one to those living on this side and then that side of the street, then to the whole country, then to the entire continent, then to all of humanity in this world, and then farther to infinite sentient beings. This is how to practice the 7 quintessential instructions of cause and effect. The other technique for developing altruism is called equalizing and switching self and other. Here, one should investigate which side is important, oneself or others. Choose. There is no other choice, only these two. Who is more important, you or others? Others are greater in number than you, who are just one. Others are infinite. It is clear that neither want suffering and both want happiness, and that both have every right to achieve happiness and to overcome suffering because both are sentient beings. If we ask, why do I have the right to be happy? The ultimate reason is, because I want happiness. There is no further reason. We have a natural and valid feeling of I on the basis of which we want happiness. It is a human right and a right of all sentient beings. Now, if one has such a right to overcome suffering, then other sentient beings have the same right. In addition, all sentient beings are endowed with the capacity to overcome suffering. The only difference is that oneself is single, whereas others are in the majority. Hence, the conclusion is clear. If even a small problem, a small suffering, befalls others, its range is infinite, whereas when something happens to oneself, it is limited to just one person. In this way, oneself seems not so important. Let me describe how I practice this in meditation. Imagine that in front of you, on one side, is your old, selfish I, and on the other side is a group of poor, needy people, and you yourself are in the middle, as a neutral third party. Then judge whether you should join the selfish, self-centered, stupid person, or these poor, needy, helpless people. If you have a human heart, you will be drawn to the side of the needy beings. This type of contemplation will help in developing an altruistic attitude. You gradually will realize how bad selfish behavior is. You yourself, up to now, have been behaving this way. But now you realize how bad you were. If we really do not want to be a bad person, then the means to avoid it is in our hands. If we train in the behavior of a good person, we will become good. Nobody else has the right to put a person in the categories of good or bad. No one has that kind of power. The ultimate source of peace in the family, the country, and the world is compassion and love. Contemplation of this also helps to develop altruism. Meditating on these techniques engenders conviction, desire, and determination. When with such determination you try, day by day, month by month, year by year, we can improve ourselves. With altruistic motivation, every action accumulates virtues, the limitless power of salutary merit. From a Buddhist viewpoint, what help can we bring others? One important type of charity is giving material things such as food, clothing, and shelter. But this is limited, for it does not bring complete satisfaction. Just as through gradual purification of our own mind, more and more happiness develops, so it is the same for others. Thus, it is crucial that others understand what practices they should adopt in order to achieve happiness. To facilitate their learning these topics, we need to be capable of teaching them. Moreover, since sentient beings have limitlessly different predispositions, interests, potential, and attitudes, we cannot fulfill the hopes of other beings unless we develop the exalted activities of speech that accord exactly with what they need. There is no way to accomplish this unless we overcome the obstructions preventing omniscience in our own mental continuums. Thus, we resolve to attain the stage of Buddhahood in which the obstructions have been extinguished. In this way, the Bodhisattva attitude is a mind intently directed toward the welfare of others, and aspiring to one's own Buddhahood to accomplish this. Though the final aim is altruistic service upon attainment of Buddhahood, in terms of present implementation, a Bodhisattva practices the 6 perfections: giving, ethics, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom, in accordance with his or her capacity, beginning with the charity of giving material things. Giving means to train from the depths of the heart an attitude of generosity such that one seeks no reward for oneself. The act of charity and all of its beneficial results are dedicated to other sentient beings. Concerning ethics, the root practice of a bodhisattva is to restrain self-centeredness. Since charity cannot involve any harm to others if it is to succeed, it is necessary to overcome the root of any tendency to harm others. This must be done through eliminating self-centeredness, since a solely altruistic attitude leaves no room for harming others. In order to have pure ethics, it is necessary to cultivate patience. The practice of patience is extremely important, since it is the main bulwark for training in the equalizing and switching of self and others. In his A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Shantideva explains the equalizing and switching of self and others. The practice of patience establishes the foundation for this. It is hardest to generate affection and respect for enemies. When one thinks of enemies in terms of the practice of patience, not only is an enemy not someone who brings harm, an enemy is the most benevolent of helpers. One comes to think, without someone to harm me, there would be no way I could cultivate the patience of being unconcerned about harm to myself. As Shantideva says, there are many beings to whom one can practice charity, but there are very few with whom one can practice patience, and what is more rare is more valuable. An enemy is really most kind. Through cultivating patience, one's power of merit increases, and the practice of patience can only be done in dependence upon an enemy. For this reason, enemies are the main instigators of the increase of meritorious power. An enemy is not someone who prevents, but in fact helps, the practice of religion. In his A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Shantideva states a hypothetical objection. But an enemy does not have a motivation to help one, and thus should not be respected. Shantideva's answer is that for something to help, it is not necessary that it have motivation. Even if enemies do not wish to help, it is suitable to respect them since they are beneficial. Thinking along these lines is very beneficial. It helps one to remain happy. Shantideva reasons that if something can be done to fix a situation, there is no need to worry. Whereas on the other hand, if there is nothing that can be done, there is no use in worrying. Another important type of patience is forbearance, the voluntary assumption of suffering. Before suffering ensues, it is important to engage in techniques to avoid it. But once suffering has started, it should be regarded not as a burden, but as something that can assist one. The reasons are many. Through undergoing small sufferings, one can purify the karma of many ill deeds accumulated in former lifetimes. Also, suffering helps reveal the disadvantages of cyclic existence, which helps to develop a dislike for engaging in non-virtues. Suffering also helps reveal the advantages of liberation. In addition, through your own suffering, you can infer what the pain of others is and generate a wish to do something for them. Thinking about suffering this way, one discovers that it provides a good opportunity for more practice and thought. The fourth of the six perfections is effort. Of the many types of effort, one is called putting on armor. It prevents dissatisfaction with the lack of immediate achievement. Effort affords a willingness to engage in enthusiastic practice for eons and eons in order to bring about development. Question. At the time of conception, does the consciousness mix with the developing physical aggregates? Or can the consciousness join the physical body later, just a few moments before birth? Answer. It is said that the consciousness enters at the time of conception itself. To murder a human means to kill either a human or something forming as a human, the latter referring to the period right after conception until birth. Question. Is abortion suitable when severe handicap has been detected in the embryo? Answer. There might be situations in which, if the child will be so severely handicapped that it will undergo great suffering, abortion is permissible. In general, however, abortion involves the taking of life and is not appropriate. The main factor is motivation. Question. What are the karmic consequences of a woman choosing to have an abortion while understanding that it is wrong to take life? Answer. It is said that if there are no mitigating circumstances, it is worse to do an ill deed knowing that it is wrong. Question. What advice can you give to those of us who have had an abortion but are currently practicing Buddhism? Answer. When a wrong deed has already been done, then after learning that it was wrong, one can disclose the faulty deed in the presence of actual or imagined holy beings and develop an intention not to do that action again in the future. This diminishes the force of the ill deed. Question. Please say something about euthanasia, which can be performed either by withholding treatment or by giving a drug that kills the person in a few minutes. Answer. Again, there may be exceptional situations, but in general, it is better to let persons die at their own time. What we undergo is due to our own past actions, and we have to accept what our karma has impelled us toward. Initially, we have to do whatever we can to avoid suffering. Then, if nothing will relieve the problem, the suffering should be understood as the unavoidable result of former actions. Question. Your Holiness, you talked about a subtle consciousness continuing as a stream from one lifetime to the next. But after liberation takes place, what happens to the stream of consciousness at the time of death? Does it continue? Answer. The subtlest level of consciousness proceeds to and through Buddhahood. It is never extinguished. Question. Many of us so enjoy living that we cannot imagine wanting to escape it. Thus, some aspects of Buddhist philosophy seem unduly depressing. Could you please comment? Answer. From a Buddhist perspective, this is a case of not understanding the various levels of suffering. If you are truly happy, then it is okay. Question. I have read about the Buddhist teaching of selflessness, which is often translated as no soul. Yesterday you spoke about the subtlest continuum of consciousness as that which passes from one birth to another and is the inheritor of karma. Is there any essential difference between the subtle consciousness and the Christian concept of soul? Answer. I wonder what a clear definition of soul is in Christianity. Since ancient times in India, there have been tenets that assert a self, Atman, which is described as being permanent, unitary, and independent. This type of soul is not asserted in Buddhism. Question. How can I overcome the strong fear of the unkind attitudes of others that I have experienced since childhood? Answer. Cultivation of an attitude of cherishing others more than yourself will gradually help. It will take time. Also, if such a thought constantly causes discomfort for you, it would be better to try to stop thinking about it. Question. What do you think of a Buddhist who does not believe in karma or rebirth? Answer. Generally, whether or not one is a Buddhist is determined by whether one asserts the three jewels, the Buddha, his doctrine, and the spiritual community, as pure sources of refuge. However, there are persons who do this without much thought on complicated matters, such as former and later births, karma, and so forth. On the other hand, some Western people who think more along these lines cannot immediately accept the three jewels and remain skeptical, but nevertheless have high regard for the Buddha, his teaching, and the spiritual community. The latter, it might be said, are persons who are about to become Buddhists. Also, although Buddhists would not assert a permanent, unitary, independent self, there could be Buddhists who would not immediately accept selflessness. Question. How is it possible to practice Buddhism while living among wife, husband, or family who do not practice? Answer. Buddhism is to be practiced individually. There is no necessity to recite texts together, for instance. Question. What is your advice to an ordinary Westerner who is working but wants to complete Tibetan Buddhist practices without becoming a monk or performing a 3-year retreat? Answer. Persons should remain in society carrying out their usual profession while internally carrying on analysis and practice. In daily life, you should go to the office, carry out your work, and return home. it would be worthwhile to sacrifice some late evening entertainment, go to sleep early, and get up early the next morning to perform analytical meditation. Then have a good breakfast and go slowly to your work. Occasionally, when you have enough money, go to a Buddhist country for a few weeks. I think this may be practical and effective. Question: how can we understand emptiness very simply without getting into too much intellectualized philosophy? Answer: is not what I have been talking about for the past few days rather simple? The main idea is that when objects are sought under analysis, they are not found. But this does not mean they do not exist. It simply means that they lack inherent existence. If you contemplate this again and again, in time, realization will emerge. Question: how should we help someone who is dying? What should we say to the dying person? Answer: it is most important not to cause disturbance in the mind of a dying person, and also it is important to activate memory of a virtuous religious practice with which the person is familiar. Those who do not accept any religion should be helped to die with a peaceful, relaxed attitude. The reason for this is that the attitude that one has near the time of death is extremely important with regard to what karma is being activated, and thus how one will be reborn in the next lifetime. For those engaged in Buddhist practice, there are many levels of reflection that a dying person can put to use. Reflecting on the meaning of emptiness, cultivating an altruistic intention to become enlightened, cultivating deity yoga, engaging in practice of the winds, and even reflecting on undifferentiable bliss and emptiness, performing the transference of consciousness, and so forth. No matter how great the benefit may be in the abstract, it is crucial that the dying person be drawn to a practice that is familiar and appropriate to his or her own level. Lecture 5: Compassion and Wisdom Combined. As mentioned earlier, an altruistically motivated person matures his or her own continuum by practicing the six perfections, and matures the continuums of others by practicing the four ways of gathering students. Among the six perfections, each of the latter ones is more difficult to achieve, and is more important than the former ones. The last two perfections are concentration and wisdom. In terms of the sutra vehicle, Maitreya's Ornament for Clear Realization presents 37 paths in harmony with enlightenment for the sake of achieving liberation, and many variations of paths for the sake of achieving Buddhahood. The root for all of these is the meditative stabilization described as a union of a calm abiding of the mind and special insight. As a means of achieving this meditative stabilization quickly and powerfully, there is the mantra or tantra vehicle, comprising four tantra sets: action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga. The three lower tantras share the same general mode of procedure, although each has distinctive practices. In both the perfection vehicle and the secret mantra vehicle, practice is rooted in the altruistic intention to become enlightened and the view of the emptiness of inherent existence. The greatness of secret mantra, on the other hand, comes by way of meditative stabilization. Thus, it is even said that the scriptures of secret mantra are included in the sets of discourses, since meditative stabilization is their main topic. In what way does the secret mantra vehicle achieve its distinctiveness through meditative stabilization? How does it have a more profound way of enhancing the meditative stabilization that is a union of calm abiding and special insight? Motivated by the altruistic intention to become enlightened, one aims at full enlightenment. That state of Buddhahood is endowed with a truth body, the fulfillment of one's own welfare, and form bodies, the fulfillment of others' welfare. These two practitioners aim to achieve form bodies in order to assist others. In the perfection vehicle within the sutra system, one seeks to achieve this type of body by accumulating meritorious power through practicing the six perfections with great compassion and the altruistic intention to become enlightened. In addition, the distinctive feature of Tantra is to engage in a technique similar to the type of form body being sought, one meditates on oneself as having the physical body of a Buddha. This is called deity yoga. Since this practice concords in aspect with the result one is trying to achieve, deity yoga is effective and powerful. In this way, a distinctive feature of secret mantra is a yoga in which method and wisdom are indivisible. In the perfection vehicle, altruistic method and wisdom are separate entities that affect each other. How are the two indivisible within Tantra? In the practice of deity yoga, a single consciousness contains these two factors, the imagination of a divine body and the ascertainment of its emptiness of inherent existence. The imagination of a divine body, which is in the class of compassionately vast appearances, accumulates the collection of merit. Hence, a mind of deity yoga fulfills the feature of altruistic method. Since the same mind ascertains the emptiness of inherent existence of the divine body, wisdom is accumulated. Thus, the mind of deity yoga fulfills the qualities of wisdom. Although method and wisdom are separable conceptually, they are contained in one consciousness. A yogi imagines him or herself in a divine body. When yogis imagine themselves as being a deity and realize the emptiness of that divine body, there is a difference in the impact of this realization due to the divine body, which is the substratum of emptiness. Also, when in the perfection vehicle one meditates on the emptiness of the self and the phenomena included in the five aggregates, one does not engage in techniques to cause the substratum to keep appearing and not to disappear. In the Tantra system, one specifically trains in maintaining the appearance of the divine body in the midst of ascertaining its emptiness of inherent existence. While imagining a divine body, the emptiness of inherent existence of that body is ascertained by the same consciousness. Thus, it is said that a factor of the wisdom consciousness that realizes emptiness appears as a deity. Highest Yoga Tantra describes an even more profound way in which altruistic method and wisdom are undifferentiable. This is understood by focusing on more subtle physical and mental factors, the very subtle wind or energy and the very subtle mind, which themselves are an undifferentiable entity. To practice this level, it is necessary to forcefully stop the coarser levels of wind and mind. Highest Yoga Tantra describes many techniques for doing this by emphasis on different places in the body. This is the practice of the channels, the winds or internal energies, and the drops of essential fluid. In general, the cultivation of special insight involves analytical meditation. But due to these special factors, in Highest Yoga Tantra, it is stabilizing meditation that is emphasized when cultivating special insight. Coarser levels of consciousness induce ascertainment through analysis and investigation. On the other hand, when one purposely manifests subtler levels of consciousness through the power of yoga, rather than at times when these happen naturally, such as while dying, these subtle consciousnesses are fully capable of ascertaining meanings. If one engages in analysis at that time, it causes the subtler level to cease and the coarser level to return. Highest Yoga Tantra prescribes two main meditational systems for achieving a Buddha body, through focusing on both very subtle wind and mind, and through focusing only on very subtle mind. It is said that, among Highest Yoga Tantras, one group focuses on the channels, winds, and drops of essential fluids in order to manifest the fundamental innate mind of clear light, and another group manifests that mind through sustaining a non-conceptual state without focusing on channels, winds, and drops. Within the first, there are tantras that put particular emphasis on the wind yoga and tantras that put emphasis on the four joys. The great seal and the great completeness are among those systems that manifest the fundamental innate mind of clear light through sustaining a non-conceptual state. Before engaging in the practice of tantra, it is necessary to receive initiation, and after receiving initiation, it is important to keep the pledges and vows that have been bestowed. In initiation, one person transmits a lineage of blessing to another, and even though blessings can be gained via other methods, such as reading books, it is better to receive a blessing from a living person's mental continuum because its benefit forms more easily in the mind. Due to this, In secret tantra, lamas are valued highly. Although Buddhism does not have a creator god, in its many forms of initiation, there are a great many gods. What are they? From the beginning of bodhisattva practice, one aims to achieve the altruistically active form bodies of a Buddha in order to bring vast effective help to other sentient beings. In Buddhahood, form bodies appear spontaneously and without exertion in order to assist others. Just as when there is a reflection of the moon, there has to be something to reflect it. So the spontaneous appearance of the form bodies of a Buddha require beings before whom to appear. Also, whether a reflection appears clearly or unclearly, big or small, depends upon the surface on which it is reflected. Similarly, the colors, shapes, and aspects of form bodies appear spontaneously to trainees relative to their interests, dispositions, beliefs, and needs. In this way, the gods of the three lower tantras appear in aspects making use of the five pleasurable attributes of the desire realm: pleasurable visible forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and tangible objects, but without joining of male and female organs. For trainees who cannot make use of these pleasurable attributes of the desire realm in the path, the form body of a Buddha appears as a supreme emanation body in the aspect of a monk, as did Shakyamuni Buddha. If trainees have the disposition to practice highest yoga tantra, and if their capacities are activated, form bodies manifest to them in the aspect of male and female deities in union. Form bodies appear in a wrathful aspect to those capable of using the factor of hatred in the path, and in a peaceful aspect to those capable mainly of using desire. Thus, form bodies appear in various ways relative to trainees' capacities. A particular Buddha could appear as a single deity, but could also manifest many emanations simultaneously. For instance, Gyhasamaja manifests as 32 persons in a mandala. But this does not mean that there are 32 persons. There is only one person. The others are just emanations. Hence, among the hosts of deities, there are many that are just reflections of one being. Now let us consider the view in the four orders of Tibetan Buddhism. When the term view is used, it is important to determine its meaning in context. View can refer either to the consciousness that views or to the object that is viewed. In highest yoga tantra, the term view refers to that which views, the consciousness that views. According to its distinctive presentation, while there is no difference in the emptiness that is viewed, there is a difference in the great bliss consciousness that views emptiness. Referring to emptiness as the object viewed, Sakya Pandita, who lived in the 13th century, says that sutra and mantra have the same view. Many Gelugpa texts similarly speak about sutra and mantra as having the same view. Nevertheless, in Sakyapa, four different views are posited with respect to the four initiations in highest yoga tantra: the view of the Vaz initiation, the view of the secret initiation, the view of the knowledge wisdom initiation, and the view of the word initiation. Similarly, some Gelugpa texts speak of highest yoga tantra as being superior due to its view, referring to the subject that views, the wisdom of great bliss. Hence, when such scholars say that there is no difference in view between sutra and mantra, they are speaking of the object being viewed, emptiness. However, when they say that sutra and mantra differ in view, they are speaking of the consciousness that views emptiness, since highest yoga tantra presents subtler levels of mind that realize emptiness in a more powerful way. Kagyupa and Nyingmapa texts similarly say that the view of mantra is superior to that of sutra. All of them refer to a distinctive, subtler type of mind. Sakyapa texts present a view of the undifferentiability of cyclic existence and nirvana, saying that it is to be delineated in terms of the causal continuum that is the basis of all. There are slightly different explanations of this causal continuum, but it generally refers to the real nature of the mind. In Sakyapa, the causal continuum is identified by the great scholar Mangto Ludrup Gyatso as the fundamental innate mind of clear light. In another interpretation within Tsakyapa, it is identified as all of the impure aggregates, constituents, and sense spheres of a person. It is also said that, in the causal continuum, all of the phenomena of cyclic existence are complete in terms of nature, all of the phenomena of the path are complete in terms of qualities, and all of the phenomena of Buddhahood are complete in terms of effects. With respect to the equality of cyclic existence in Nirvana, in the sutra system, Nagarjuna says in his 60 stanzas of reasoning, both cyclic existence and Nirvana do not inherently exist. Just that which is knowledge of cyclic existence is called Nirvana. In the sutra system, Nirvana is the reality into which all sufferings and sources of suffering are extinguished when one has thoroughly understood the absence of inherent existence of cyclic existence. A Tsakyapa presentation of the equality of cyclic existence in Nirvana explains that the impure phenomena of the mental and physical aggregates primordially exist as pure aggregates. Four mandalas are presented as the foundation, these being the channels of the body, the winds, the drops of essential fluid, and letters. These are viewed as entities of the four bodies of a Buddha. According to Mangto Ludrup Gyatso, all of the phenomena of cyclic existence and Nirvana are to be viewed as the sport or reflection of the fundamental innate mind of clear light, since they share the same taste in the sphere of clear light. Thus, the doctrine of the undifferentiability of cyclic existence and Nirvana stems from the fundamental mind. In Kajupa, meditation on the Great Seal is done by way of four yogas: one-pointed, non-elaborative, one-taste, and non-meditative. The first two are said to be in common with the sutra path. Through one-pointed yoga, calm abiding of the mind is achieved, and through non-elaborative yoga, special insight into emptiness is achieved. Through one-taste yoga, an extraordinary special insight is achieved in which all appearing and occurring phenomena are seen as one taste in the fundamental innate mind of clear light. When this path, which is unique to Tantra, increases in strength, it becomes non-meditative yoga. As Nagarjuna says in his five stages, when one arrives at the union of pure body and pure mind, there is nothing new to learn. About the view of the Great Seal it is said, the very mind is the innate truth body, appearances are the waves of the innate truth body. The very mind, or basic mind, is the innate truth body, the fundamental mind of clear light. All pure and impure appearances are the sport of that truth body. They dawn from within the fundamental mind of clear light. In Gelugpa, it could be said that a view like that of the Great Seal is a special view of the Middle Way. Such a special view is found in meditations on the view of the Middle Way that are combined with highest yoga tantra. When one thinks in these terms, the innate level of the union of bliss and emptiness in Gelugpa presentations of highest yoga tantra are the same as that of the Great Seal. Gelugpa texts on sutra and even on mantra emphasize the view as the object viewed, that is to say, emptiness. Nevertheless, their texts on mantra speak frequently about the view in terms of the subject, the viewing consciousness. Also, it is said that all pure and impure phenomena, understood as the sport of emptiness, are also to be seen as the sport of the subject, the viewing consciousness, the innate mind of clear light. The yogi, while abiding in illusion-like meditative stabilization, is to view all appearing and occurring phenomena, environments and beings within them, as the sport of illusion-like meditative stabilization. In the view of the great completeness, the mode of explanation is different, but the referent is the same. In the great completeness, the root reference is to the fundamental innate mind of clear light, but it is called ordinary consciousness. A distinction is drawn between mind and basic mind. Ordinary consciousness refers to basic mind. In the Nyingmapa system, highest yoga tantra itself is divided into three categories: Mahayoga, Anuyoga, and Atiyoga. Atiyoga, or the Great Completeness, is also divided into three: the class of mind, the class of the Great Vastness, and the class of quintessential instructions. all of the texts of Highest Yoga Tantra in all of the New Translation and Old Translation schools teach only the practice of the fundamental innate mind of clear light. The difference between them is explained as follows. Within other systems, in the beginning stages, one makes use of many practices that involve conceptuality, through which the fundamental innate mind of clear light is manifested. In the great completeness, on the other hand, conceptuality is not stressed. Emphasis is placed on basic mind and dependence upon quintessential instructions. This is why it is called a doctrine free from exertion. Because in the great completeness, tremendous emphasis is placed on the fundamental innate mind of clear light, it includes an uncommon presentation of the two truths, called the special two truths. It could roughly be said that what is fundamental and innate is the ultimate truth, and anything that is adventitious is a conventional truth. From this perspective, the fundamental innate mind of clear light is empty of all conventional truths that are adventitious phenomena, and thus it is an other emptiness. That is to say, it is empty of what is other. Still, the fundamental innate mind of clear light is said to have a nature of essential purity, and hence does not pass beyond the nature of the emptiness of inherent existence set forth in the middle wheel of Buddha's teaching. This other emptiness is in a context of compatibility between the emptiness of inherent existence of the middle wheel and the Buddha nature as it is presented in the third wheel. Because of this, it is described in some oral traditions as a good other emptiness, whereas bad other emptiness stresses only the Buddha nature at the expense of the middle wheel, advocating that the Buddha nature does inherently exist. In this way, many qualified scholars from all of the schools of Tibetan Buddhism have refuted an other emptiness that both presents a final truth that is itself inherently existent and looks down on the emptiness of inherent existence as an annihilatory self-emptiness to be derided. As is said by the great Lama Chinse Jamyang Chöki Lodru, when the great Nyingmapa adept Longchen Rupjam gives a presentation of the ground, path, and fruit, he does so mainly from the perspective of the enlightened state of a Buddha, whereas the Sakyapa presentation is mainly from the perspective of the spiritual experience of a yogi on the path, and the Gelugpa presentation is mainly from the perspective of how phenomena appear to ordinary sentient beings. Through this statement, many misunderstandings can be removed. In practicing systems that emphasize both wind and mind, one achieves a union of pure body and pure mind, illusory body and mind of clear light, independence upon which the supremely altruistic effective state of Buddhahood is attained. In the uncommon mode of procedure of the Mother Tantras, Buddhahood is achieved by way of a rainbow body. In the Kala Chakra system, which emphasizes the mind, Buddhahood is attained independence upon a union of a body of empty form and supreme immutable bliss. The Nyingmapa system of the Great Completeness also emphasizes mainly the mind. Therein, all of the coarse factors of one's body are consumed in dependence upon completion of four levels of appearance, and one achieves a rainbow body of great transference. All of these embodiments of wisdom and compassion exist for the sake of helping other beings extricate themselves from the round of suffering impelled by ignorance.